We're back tomorrow with Here and Now at 2 o'clock. Stay with us for Virginia Insight next. Today we're discussing the results from our most recent election and what they may tell us about how Virginia might vote in the future. And your questions about how things might move forward with Virginia politics are welcome, too. Virginia Insight is next on listener-supported WMRA Harrisonburg, 90.7, WMRY Crozet Charlottesville, 103.5, WMRL Lexington, 89.9, WMLU Farmville, 91.3, and Winchester, 94.5. Got about a 30% chance of some light snow overnight tonight or early in the morning. And as it stands right now, the National Weather Service says there's little or no snow accumulation expected. Our overnight lows will be in the low 30s. Tomorrow's highs around 40. It's 3 o'clock.
Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. So, the Commonwealth has a new governor-elect, a Democrat, a new lieutenant governor-elect, a Democrat, and at some point we will have a new state attorney general as well. But man, is that attorney general's race close? So, we will start with the obvious, last week's election, and if you've got any idea what it all means, please do give us a call at 888-WMRA-TALK. A bit later in this hour, we'll take another close-up look at what's really going on with so-called Obamacare. A Virginia public health law specialist who knows the ins and outs of the Affordable Care Act probably as well as anyone has agreed to give us a few minutes out of his super hectic day. Then we're going to connect with at least one and possibly two key Virginia elections types as we attempt to get to the very latest news on the last provisional ballots that are still being counted. And if you want to join in at any point, in all numbers, we are at 888-967-2825. With us by phone already, former Virginia political reporter for The Washington Post and now White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar. Joining in from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the leader of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. And here with me in the Insight studio at WMRA, public policy guru and political scientist from James Madison University, Bob Roberts. Gang, it has been so long since we've been together. What's been happening?
What? Well, last week we had a little election.
Oh, Mr. Gibson. So please do tell. Can you give us your thumbnail sketch of what
Well,
Took
it was
place.
Unusual. It was an unusual election for governor of Virginia. For one thing, the party in power in the White House kept the governorship, which hasn't happened since the early 1970s. For another thing, the party in power lost the governorship. The party in power in the governorship lost after only 4 years, which hasn't happened for over 100 years or a long, long, long time. And for the first time in our history, most of the money that was spent on behalf of the two major party candidates for governor, Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat and winner, and Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general who lost as a Republican, most of the money for each candidate was from out of state. We had a greater turnout of the voters than we were expecting, and that happened 4 years ago, a 42.6% turnout, which is above the 40.2 or 40.4% turnout we had 4 years ago when Bob McDonnell won easily the governorship. And Terry McAuliffe won by 2.5 points, which is less than polls had indicated. A lot of people might expect a larger margin for governor. It looked like the race closed toward the end. The lieutenant governor's race was not close. Senator Ralph Northam won over Republican E.W. Jackson by greater than 10.5 points, which is a blowout margin.
Northam the Democrat, Jackson
Northam the
Republican.
Democrat, from Norfolk. And in the attorney general's race, we have a grand total of 17 votes right now separating the leader in that race, the Republican attorney general candidate, Mark Obenchain, who leads by 17 votes only over the Democratic nominee, Mark Herring, a state senator from Loudoun County. And that is headed for a recount and may change again in terms of numbers of votes as they tally the last votes this week before the vote becomes official.
You know, I had those numbers in front of me, and I realize it's really hard to do math. Well, it's hard for me all the time, but it's hard when you're listening to the radio. But the numbers are impressive. At this point, what the State Board of Elections is showing, Actually, in percentages, they have both Mark Obenshain, the Republican, and Mark Herring, the Democrat, tied at percent of vote at 49.88%, because they don't go to the additional decimal point. But in actual numbers of votes, 1,103,443 for Mr. Obenshain, who's leading. Okay? So this is the number you would subtract from that, that I'm going to tell you next. The Democrat Mark Herring is behind because he only has 1,103,426. So all you need to know really there is one guy has 43 at the end of his number. The other guy has 26 at the end of his number. So there's 17 apart. Hey, Anita.
Yes.
I so seldom get to give you a hard time. It seems to me that I recall when we were last together, you thought that the race was not going to be close at all.
Well, thanks for putting me on the spot. I didn't say that on the air, but since you've outed me, I guess I was taken by the public polling. I mean, there was basically Terry McAuliffe had led in every poll since July, and some of the margins were small, but some were huge. I mean, you know, double digits. And even there near the end, there were some showing him 10-plus points ahead. It's interesting now that the race is over, the McAuliffe camp says their internal polling showed them at about 2 or 3 points difference, that they would win by 2 to 3 points. We don't have the luxury of knowing all those things beforehand. But, you know, that's one of the things that the Republicans, Ken Cuccinelli's camp says, is that I think there were a lot of factors in this race but one that hurt him. But one of the things they do say is, you know, the public polling really hurt them. Showing them 10 points and more behind made people not want to give them money or support them. Or, you know, the Republican national committees, they say, didn't put as enough money into them, into their race, into their campaign, just because it looked like they were really going to lose. So
there were two states last Tuesday
right.
that had governor's races, Virginia and New Jersey are the only states that do it in this off year time every 4 years. And of course, New Jersey reelected its Republican governor because it doesn't, unlike Virginia, where we limit our governor to just one term. That's not the case in Virginia.
Right. And that was widely expected. Not a lot of people paying attention for sure. There's Chris Christie's a national figure, but nobody thought that he had any chance of losing.
But not everybody, I'm sure, thought it was going to be such a blowout. Chris Christie, the Republican, winning by 22 points over his Democratic challenger. And he's been making the rounds of the Sunday talk shows. He was on Meet the Press yesterday, and when he was asked why he won so big, this is what he said.
I think, David, what you saw from the election results on Tuesday is pretty simple. People want the folks they elect to get the job done, to do their job, get it done for the people who elect you. And that's why, you know, when you look at what happened on Tuesday, it's about what's happened over the last 4 years. 143,000 new private sector jobs, cutting business taxes, controlling property taxes, reforming teacher tenure for the first time in 100 years, and reforming a pension and benefit system to save $120 billion over the next 30 years for taxpayers. It's that kind of record that people were supporting.
Dr. Bob Roberts from James Madison University, is Governor Christie correct that he won so big just because he gets the job done, and that is somehow different than the Republican candidate here in Virginia, who was attorney general for 4 years before he tried to become governor and lost by only 2.5 points?
Christie avoided the social issues that cost Cuccinelli the race, and Christie went to Washington and got tens of billions of dollars in federal aid that Republicans have been frowning upon. So in a sense, Christie had to fight his own party, if we remember, to get that aid out of Washington when many members of his own party. So for Christie to say that he's been saying, that he's a traditional Republican, which he's trying to make that case to the Republican base, is probably not accurate, since he is not wearing the social issues on his sleeves, and he has no qualms about taking tens of billions of dollars in federal aid when his own party wants to cut federal aid. So in a sense, the real question is, will this brand of Republicanism sell outside of New Jersey?
Well, Bob Gibson, is there a lesson here? What happened in Virginia? What happened in New Jersey? If you compare the two, do we learn anything?
Well, I think Bob Roberts is right on the social issues that the governor of New Jersey could have stopped gay marriage, at least temporarily, in his state and didn't stand in the way as New Jersey became the 15th, 14th or 15th state to acknowledge and allow gay marriage. Whereas, can anyone picture the Republican Attorney General of Virginia getting out of the way and allowing gay marriage in Virginia? Not that Virginia is about to adopt it, but I think you know, Ken Cuccinelli, the Attorney General Republican nominee in Virginia for governor, was far more outspoken on many social issues, had been the first Attorney General to rush to court to try to stop Obamacare, and had sued the University of Virginia trying to get access to some climate change science materials. And I think the social issues just did the top of the ticket in. The two candidates at the top of the Republican ticket could not raise enough money to run the campaigns they needed to run. They were heavily, heavily outspent by more than $13 million more by the Democrats, by Terry McAuliffe for governor, because they were so divisive on the social issues.
I think a good example is to look at 4 years ago in Virginia. If we're looking at a Virginia example, Bob McDonnell, the current governor, Republican, ran. He is a conservative and had many conservative votes and bills when he was a legislator. He was attorney general, and there is no disputing he's conservative. He didn't run on those issues at all. He ran on jobs over and over again, Bob's for jobs. And he was very disciplined about it, and in his 4 years, he's shown, while still a conservative, still a Republican, that wasn't his top priority. I mean, if Ken Cuccinelli had done that sort of thing, if he was able to do that, it might have been a different story.
Our analysis panel today on Virginia Insight, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and we've got the phone line open. If you have any thoughts political that you'd like to share about the election or anything else, we are at 888-WMRA-TALK. So what I'm wondering here, Bob Roberts and the rest of the gang, it seems to me that you're going to have people say, you've got a Chris Christie in New Jersey, an obviously dark blue state that votes heavily for Democrats in presidential elections, gives him an overwhelming win to put him in a second term as governor. And then you've got a purple state with lots of red history like Virginia, with a social conservative running for governor who only loses by 2.5 points. And as Bob Gibson was just saying, he was heavily outspent, largely, I don't know if Mr. Gibson mentioned this, because the Republican establishment decided not to contribute to Mr. Cuccinelli's campaign.
He claims they didn't, but the Republican National Committee and Governor's Association gave him $13 million.
But there were lots of big donors who've contributed to other Republican campaigns in Virginia who did not contribute and specifically said, at least being quoted in newspaper articles around the state, you know, I'm not contributing to Mr. Cuccinelli because he's too conservative on this because of his stand on social issues.
I'm
trying to ask you, Bob, mm-hmm. is, isn't it possible that some people who think that Mr. Cuccinelli is pure on Republican issues, on the social conservative mm-hmm. issues that at least the Tea Party element of the Republican Party seems to think is so important, that they're ideology could win if only they got the kind of support that they deserve from the Republican establishment?
I disagree. I think what happened here, if you look at 2008 for the Obama campaign, 2012, that the McAuliffe people did exactly what Obama did in 2008 and 2012, and it wouldn't have mattered if Cuccinelli had another $5 million. They identified their voters, they got them out, and they won. And I think they would have gotten them out even if Cuccinelli had $5 million, $10 million more.
We're going to hit the break here in a second. If you listening have any theories about whether there are lessons from the election, whether your viewpoint tends to be largely Democratic, largely Republican, or somewhere in between, we sure would love to hear from you. I think we've got Richard in Amherst is going to be our first call when we get back from the break. And we've also got some stuff coming up about Obamacare 2, all coming up just a bit more than 1 minute. You're tuned to Virginia Insight. Our analysis panel, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from James Madison University's Politics Department, Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. We're going to Amherst. Richard, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
My comment is, I believe Cuccinelli injured himself. It didn't have to do with money. When I have asked women how they were going to vote, the first comment is, if they're not voting for him, I think that his efforts to change the laws that women have come to believe in cost him dearly.
Richard, thank you so much for that analysis, and I'm sorry that we're going to go off topic for a moment, but please stay tuned because I want our panel to respond to what you've just said. But we now have somebody with us by phone who only has a very few minutes with us before he has to go to his next conference call. Joining us on the line now is public health law specialist Timothy Jost, author of several books on health law and professor of law at Washington and Lee University. Mr. Jost, welcome back to the Inside Airwaves.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, Tim, with all the controversy that the news media has been focusing on Obamacare in the past couple of weeks, I wanted to ask you, is there some key information about the Affordable Care Act that you suspect the public is not getting and that you wish they did have?
Well, I think the public is getting an awful lot of information right now about the Affordable Care Act. I'm not sure all of it is accurate or balanced. There are a couple of issues that have come up that have been getting a lot of press lately. One of them is this question of cancellations in the individual market. And there are millions of Americans right now who are getting notices that the coverage that they had for 2013 is being terminated. I think it's important to understand what these notices mean. The individual market has always been very volatile, and it's not at all uncommon for people to get notices at the end of a coverage year that the policy that they have had is no longer available. But insurers are required under existing law that really predated the Affordable Care Act to offer people alternatives, and that's what's happening now. Individuals are losing the coverage under the policy that they had because many of those policies are no longer legal under the new law, but they are being offered alternatives.
Tim, let me just double check something. That when you say they're no longer legal under the new law, I guess most cases that's because they don't provide as much coverage as the government says a health insurance plan should. But didn't the law also allow insurance companies to keep those policies in effect until the end of 2014?
No. Well, what the law did was to say that if you have, and this is the president's famous promise that I think at this point he probably regrets, or at least regrets not having made a little more clearly, any policy that was in effect as of the date when the law was passed on March 23rd, 2010, can continue to be in effect even though it no longer complies with the law, as long as it doesn't change significantly. The problem is that because of the turnover in the individual market, there aren't that many people that still have policies that were issued in 2010 that are still in effect. And furthermore, the law only said that those policies continued to be legal. It didn't require insurers to continue to honor them. So some insurers are now canceling what are called grandfathered policies because, for whatever reason, they no longer want to continue to issue them. And so but the law never said any policy you ever buy in the future you'll be able to keep forever. That would have completely undermined the purpose of the law, which was in part to provide more comprehensive coverage to people, but also to provide coverage that had out-of-pocket limits that were lower than many that now exist in the individual market, and perhaps most importantly, to be able to outlaw pre-existing condition exclusions and to make sure that anybody can get coverage even if they are in poor health. And so a lot of people that prior to this time have been completely frozen out of the individual health insurance market will be able to get coverage. People who had very high premiums because they had medical problems will be able to get affordable coverage. But at the same time, some people who have been able for some time now to benefit from lower premiums because they were healthy or because they were male or because they had other favorable characteristics are going to be paying higher rates. The other thing that is just terribly important is that the website isn't working. So even though many people who are now having to get new coverage will be eligible for premium tax credits, that will significantly lower the cost of their plans and in many cases even lower the cost sharing under their plans, can't find that out because they can't get on the website.
Anita Kumar, most people are of the opinion, it seems, that eventually the website's going to be fixed, whether it is in fact the end of this month or it takes a few weeks after that. But that problem's going to go away. What you have been reporting on lately is the degree to which there may be upset coming about millions of people losing their health insurance or losing the plans they currently have. Right. Tell us what you've been finding out and whether you have a question for Tim Jost.
I do. Well, we have reported that the numbers are probably even higher than the administration has put out there. Actually, they really haven't put out a number. That's part of the problem. They say they can't possibly tell us how many people could be whose insurance could be canceled or their coverage could be canceled because that's proprietary. The insurance companies know that. And that might be the case. But in 2010, they did put together an estimate. And so the estimate is far greater than people have talked about. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean all these people are going to lose their coverage, but these are plans that are changing that by their definition, if your plan changes, you could lose coverage and that sort of thing. So we've estimated it as high as 52 million. But what I wanted to ask you was that last week the president apologized for this in a national TV interview on Thursday on NBC. He apologized and he said that his administration is going to look into this and do what they can. I guess I'd sort of have two questions. Is it possible at the administrative level to do anything to help people whose plans are being canceled? And do we even want that? Is that sort of go away from, you know, go against what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to do? We knew that some of this would happen, you know, for the greater good, as the president would say. So is that really even something that he should want to fix?
Well, that's a very good question. And in answer to your first question, it's hard for me to imagine much that could be done to fix the problem insofar as what's happening is people who will not be eligible for premium tax credits seeing higher costs. The president cannot just unilaterally appropriate funds to cover people's costs. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the insurance companies are scared to death that what the president or Congress, and there's some proposed legislation pending on this, may do is to simply divide the risk pool again and try to bring down rates for people who are currently insured. But the effect of that would be to dramatically increase the cost of people who were the people whom this law was supposed to help.
Right.
And so I don't see that as a realistic alternative.
Tim Jost, Anita asked about administrative action. Is it possible that one of the problems here is as any big new social legislation is rolled out, you find problems that you'd like to go back to your legislative body and correct, but you really can't with a Republican House that says all we want to do with this piece of legislation is kill it?
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, we've got gridlock right now, and if the insistence is that we refuse to fix anything here, we just want to get rid of the whole thing, then that pretty much limits the possibilities of what you can do. But the proposals that are out there right now, you know, they may be short-term fixes, but in the long term, I think they completely undermine what this law was trying to accomplish. One other thing, you may have talked about this already, and excuse me if you had, but I think we just have to mention the Medicaid expansion, if you haven't already talked about it, with the election of Governor McAuliffe, I think that, he ran on the platform of expanding Medicaid If the Democrats control the Senate, which I suppose they will do if they hold on to Northam's seat, the Senate already favors Medicaid expansion, thanks to our local hero, Emmett Hanger. And so I think the big question is it possible to move the House on this? But that, I think, for Virginia is the most important question. We have hundreds of thousands of people who need health care, who could get it through the Medicaid expansion. The state's going to lose almost $4 billion a year if we don't expand Medicaid and 30,000 jobs. And I just see this as a no-brainer, and I'm hoping this election is going to bring that about.
Tim, we're already 1 minute past where you told us you absolutely had to be off the line because you've got another appointment. There's so many complexities here. We need to get you back on the air for a full hour sometime soon.
I'd be happy to do that.
And we'll look forward to that.
Thank you very much.
Timothy Jost is author of several books on health law and health care policy. He's also the Willett Family Professor of Law at Washington and Lee University. Tim, as always, it's a pleasure spending time with you.
Tom, sorry I can't be on longer.
We'll look forward to doing more soon. So, we have another person. Okay, well, with us now, the man who oversees much of the elections operations for the entire Commonwealth. He is Secretary of the Virginia State Board of Elections, Don Palmer. Welcome to Virginia Insight.
Welcome, sir. How are you?
Well, Mr. Palmer, all results at this point, of course, are unofficial, but it seems clear that the race for governor and lieutenant governor have been decided, yet provisional ballots are proving all important in this extremely close state attorney general contest. So what can you tell us about the status of counting provisional ballots at this point?
Well, the counting of provisional ballots is pretty much complete, except for Fairfax County, where they are actually in session right now and may have just got out of that provisional ballot meeting. It may go on into the afternoon and maybe even in tomorrow. But for the most part, I saw a few counties that had not reported, but they have done so. And so we're really waiting on Fairfax to complete their provisional count and provide those results to us.
Bob Roberts, you got a question for Mr. Palmer by chance?
On the provisional, the deadline was Friday for voters to come back in to verify their voting eligibility. Was that correct?
Friday was the deadline for if you had forgotten an ID or did not have an ID to provide that by one of the means possible by Friday at noon. A lot of counties or localities waited until noon on Friday to finish their provisionals, waiting for giving the opportunity for voters to provide that information.
Do you have any idea actually how many provisional ballots were actually counted by localities, or is that information not available?
I don't have the total counted, but normally you would have less than 50% of provisional ballots counted, because for the most part, provisionals are for voters who weren't registered, did not register in time, or voted in the wrong precinct, and there's no area in the law that we could count those. So for the most part, you'll probably have a little bit less than half of provisional votes counted.
Do we know how many were totally cast this time?
It's just above 3,000.
Okay.
That we. 3,000 provisional ballots.
Okay.
So, Don Palmer, Secretary of the Virginia State Board of Elections, I was able to obtain information this morning from just one locality. I talked to some really nice, helpful people at the Charlottesville City Board of Elections, and they told me that they had 37, what I guess they called regular provisional ballots, and then 5 ID ballots. Now, those last 5 would be people who were not allowed to vote, particularly because of the new law requiring more ID than in the past. And what I understand that out of that, then 37 plus 5 is 42, more math, sorry. But out of those 42 provisionals, they were able to cast 13 as permissible ballots. Does that sound about normal to you, 13 out of 42?
It does, actually, because, like I said, it's less than half. For the most part, when a voter shows up, if they're on the rolls and in their correct precinct, they're going to show up and be able to vote a regular ballot. There are some circumstances where, for example, someone asks for an absentee, they come to the polls, and they're asked to vote a provisional ballot because they have an absentee ballot out there. And so those would be counted, obviously, if they had not already cast it. But that does seem about normal. It's a little bit less than 50%, but that's normally what we see, is that for the most part, the people that are eligible to vote who show up will be able to vote a regular ballot. That's certainly our goal. Provisional ballot is a safeguard, an emergency ballot, where perhaps a more investigation would help the voter and get that ballot to count.
Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute over there in Charlottesville, I so wish I could make eye contact with you, but I'm psychically kind of guessing that you might have a question for Don Palmer.
I would love to ask Don. Don, do you have any idea if there are any elections in Virginia other than the Attorney General's race likely headed to a recount?
That's a very good question. I have not heard officially that there is. There was a number of close House of Delegate races, and there are a number of Board of Supervisor races that were very close, some within, obviously within the margin of recount. And so there are a number, but I don't have those on my fingertips. We're trying to deal with the statewide issue.
And if we get a recount, how long is it likely to take? Into mid-December? Is that pretty much the window in which we will have to learn, we have to wait to learn who wins the Attorney General's race?
Well, we do have a certified election on the November 25th, and then the campaign has 10 days to, the losing campaign has 10 days to request a recount. And that recount, I would guess, anywhere from 7 days to 2 weeks. And then if after that recount they wish to contest the election, they can do that as well. 3 days after the final results of the recount are in. And so it really depends on the campaign that requested, and then I believe a recount court would probably establish either a week to 2 weeks for that process to take place. It could be longer, though. It's up to the court, I believe. And then there's 3 days after that, and so we could be in the middle of December before we know.
Final question, and this may be one you don't know the answer to, but can you tell us what's happening to fill the seat of Lieutenant Governor-elect Ralph Northam in the Norfolk area? I know the Democrats are nominating from among three candidates quite soon, and there are as many as five or more Republicans running for that seat. Do you know when the election might be?
Well, for that special election, we will have to wait and see. Once there's an opening, if the obviously there has to be a resignation of the seat, and then the governor, either the governor, the city governor, or the next governor would have to set the timetable for that special election. So it's also a little bit up in the air. We are trying to plan for what the governor or the next governor will do, but it's sort of up in the air. But we basically have to wait until there's a resignation, and then the governor can set the schedule for that special election.
So we could start the General Assembly session in the second week of January with 19 Democrats and 20 Republicans in the Senate.
It's very possible, yes.
Anita, we got 30 seconds. Last question to you if you want it. Otherwise, I'll take it.
You can take it. Go for it.
So this race we have right now, Mr. Palmer, for state attorney general, with Mr. Obenchain, the Republican, leading over Democrat Herring by 17 votes. That's likely to change when those provisional ballots come in from Fairfax County?
The numbers have gone back and forth. You'll see with the canvassing, you'll see some adjustment of numbers. You'll also see with the provisionals that it's going to be very close. One candidate may take a majority of the provisional ballots. It's going to be very close, and until we get the final results, I hate to speculate on where it will end.
Well, Don Palmer is Secretary of the Virginia State Board of Elections, and we are so grateful for your time, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
We've got to go to a break, and then we're actually going to speak to somebody who has been overseeing that all-important count of provisional ballots in Fairfax County. But we got to pause for about 1 minute. Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for some 3 decades before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar is still best known to many across the Commonwealth as the reporter who did such exceptional work covering Virginia politics for the Washington Post for so many years. But she's now changed her focus a bit to national and international news in her role as White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. And with us now, the man who oversees by far the largest local elections operation anywhere in the Commonwealth. He is Secretary of the Fairfax County, Virginia Board of Elections, Brian Shoneman. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on today.
So I understand you've been kind of busy there with provisional ballots, and your locality, I understand, is going to be, because it's so big and you've got so many, the last to turn in your count?
We are the last and greatest, of course.
Has the count been finalized?
It has not. We are still in the process of interviewing voters. We allow, because of the closeness of the races, we extended the hours that we would allow voters to come in and to provide us with information in person. We have provided today from 10 to 4, and tomorrow from 10 o'clock to 1 p.m. for voters to come in and provide us any in-person information that they would like to give us that would help us to adjudicate their provisional ballots.
Do you know, Brian, how many? I'm sorry, we've got some breakup on your line. But let me try and ask this. Do you know how many provisional ballots were cast on Election Day?
We have 493 provisional ballots that have been cast. Through our process, we have at this point adjudicated 172, and we have accepted all 172 of those. We still have approximately 300 or so to go.
So you've got known 172 votes that have not been turned in yet?
That is correct. That have not been counted. That's correct.
And so with the state attorney general's race, the Republican ahead by only 17 votes, that could very well change.
That could very well change. Absolutely.
Anita Kumar?
Sure. I have a couple questions. I guess the one thing is there were two things that I've heard a lot about going on in Fairfax. One, maybe you could just tell the listeners, explain what happened with the machine that didn't count all the votes from the beginning. There was some problem with that. Could you kind of explain what happened?
Sure. We had a perfect storm of errors in the 8th Congressional District Central Absentee Precinct. As we count all of our absentee ballots, we do so by congressional district. We had a machine go down while we were counting ballots in the 8th District cap on Election Day. We transferred the memory card from that machine to a new machine and proceeded to rerun ballots through the new machine and to tabulate another group of votes into that machine. And what ended up happening was, at the end of the day, when we went to tabulate the results, the staff chose the wrong machine tape. They tabulated the machine tape that broke, which only had 710 ballots on it, instead of the machine tape that was accurate, that included that 710 and another 1,900 ballots that had been counted for a total of 2,688 ballots. They did not include those results in the tabulation. That was the error. That was the big error that made our numbers look so wrong, that clued my friend Dave Wasserman from the Cook Political Report and Ben Tribbett and Jerry Connolly's staff into the idea that our numbers were not accurate.
Okay.
Those we caught in our canvas and have been corrected since. It was basically a perfect storm, a machine error that turned into a human error that caused a whole bunch of problems.
Question.
Just a second. Okay. I think Anita had a second question.
Right. Yeah, go ahead. That's fine.
Okay. Well, then, Bob, go ahead.
Okay.
I was trying to be polite to the person.
On those 172 ballots, or let's say some more provisionals that are counted, can the party challenge those? In other words, can there be an appeal to your board or to a court not to count those provisionals when you've...
The only way that would happen would be in a contest. A recount that, when Don was talking about recounts, he gave a pretty accurate description. The reality, though, is that we are the final arbiter on whether or not a provisional ballot should be counted short of a contest. So in a recount situation, the courts are only going to recount the ballots that we have adjudicated as being accepted. So right now in the process, we go into closed session. Mm-hmm. We talk about every single ballot. The staff provides all the information that's come from the voters, from our interviews, as well as the research the staff has done on every ballot. We go into open session, and then we vote on each ballot. So the parties do have an opportunity at that point to object if they disagree.
Brian, who's we?
Their objections are on the record, and that's as far as it goes.
Who's the we, everybody on the board?
The electoral board, the three of us on the electoral board, yes.
Okay, and so you vote on whether any and each of those provisional ballots should be accepted as legitimate.
Correct.
And so far you voted yay on 172.
That is correct.
But in a contest...
What does a contest mean?
A contest is after the results of the election have been certified, after a mm-hmm. recount, that there are judicial provisions where the election can be challenged, correct?
That is correct.
After a recount?
After a recount.
Okay. So that would be pretty far down the line. One final question, then we'll let you go, Brian Schindelman. Based on what we heard from you earlier, it sounds like the soonest you're going to be able to turn in your finalized count of provisional ballots in the largest voting district in Virginia is tomorrow evening?
That's correct. We're hoping it'll be sooner than tomorrow evening, but the reality is we've got to work through the last bunch of ballots here and adjudicate every single one before we can begin counting any of them. So we're going to knock out, we're going to work through the night. We've already told the staff and my fellow board members, we will be here till we have to be here.
And
so
you're allowing voters
working
who,
on it, we're going to be doing it.
You're allowing voters who normally would have had to have provided information by Friday to prove that they were legitimate voters and have their provisional ballot counted. You're now allowing them until what time tomorrow to come in with that proof?
They can come in as late as 1 o'clock tomorrow. We're going to be open from 10 to 1 tomorrow to take voter information. But just to be clear, there are no deadlines in the code for when individuals can come and present us information. And our policy, our practice has always been if a voter comes in while we're still in the process of adjudicating ballots, we want to take their information. We want to hear from them. It's an information fact-gathering process. It's not a legal process.
Mm-hmm.
There are two deadlines in the codes for the provisional ballot meeting. One is for voter ID provisionals only. Voters have until noon on the Friday following the election to get us copies of their ID. And we have to conclude our provisional ballot meeting by no later than 7 days after the election, which, because today's a holiday, would fall tomorrow. So we're abiding by both of those provisions, and we are looking forward to getting this wrapped up.
Brian Schindelman, it's so fascinating to get a peek behind the curtain at what you guys are working on, and it sounds like you're dealing with an awful lot. Mr. Schindelman is Secretary of the Fairfax County, Virginia Board of Elections. Sir, thank you so very much for spending some time with us on Virginia Insight.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
We have just a few minutes left to take phone calls, so if you've got anything political you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you because we got some open lines at 888-WMRA-TALK. But before we got into those phone experts, we had a call from Richard in Amherst, whose theory about the overall results for the governor's race were based on how women viewed the Republican candidate. Anita, am I recalling this correctly?
You had to remind me because it was so long ago.
Yes.
But yes, I believe that's what he said. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it is true that more women voted for Terry McAuliffe than Ken Cuccinelli. In fact, though, I believe the number was smaller than people were saying it was going to be 20-some points difference, and I believe it was maybe more like 10.
It was about 8 points.
Eight, yeah.
Eight percentage more women voted for McAuliffe than voted for the Republican Cuccinelli.
Right, and if you looked at single women, it was far greater.
42%.
42?
Yeah.
42%. Single. That's huge.
Now, what's also important to remember that the Democrats only got 35% of the white vote, which was something that was somewhat surprising, that McAuliffe won because he was able to turn out African-American votes and Hispanic voters. So that was very much reflective of what Obama. And there was some question whether McAuliffe would be able to do that. Of those women voters, white women voted for Cuccinelli. Only 35% of white women voted for McAuliffe. So it was very important in terms of turning out minority voters for his victory.
Bob Gibson, as far as I know, the state attorney general, Ken Cuccinelli, Republican candidate for governor, has not yet conceded the election or congratulated his opponent. One, am I correct in that? And two, is that unprecedented?
In recent elections, that's quite unprecedented. And I am still surprised to learn that Ken Cuccinelli hasn't made that concession call and that call to Terry McAuliffe that is normal, traditional, and expected. So this was a very bitter and very personal race. The issues were not big issues between the two, as much as they were big issues about the two candidates. And it was nasty. It was personal. The ads were predominantly negative about the other guy. And I think Ken Cuccinelli thought that he was going to win, or thought that that this had tightened enough that he could win. And when he didn't, when he was 2.5 points shy of a victory, and the Republicans are now looking for all sorts of reasons to blame fellow Republicans and others for that loss, he has not found it in his heart yet to make that concession call.
I think they're probably going to run into each other in the next 2 months. I mean, Ken Cuccinelli remains the state attorney general, and Terry McAuliffe is already in Richmond gearing up for his administration. I mean, he's there doing things every day, so I'm sure their paths will cross.
We're going next to Charlottesville. Jenny, thanks for calling us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts, and or Anita Kumar, please.
Hi. Yeah, my daughter's in college in North Carolina and applied for an absentee ballot here in Alamo
County. I'm sorry, there was a breakup on the line. Your daughter's in college where?
In North Carolina.
North Carolina, okay.
And applied for an absentee ballot in Elmore County and never got it. And we didn't realize that until the day of the election, and she was down there, and there was nothing we could do at that point. But it really did make me wonder, you know, with all the shenanigans the Republicans were pulling in Virginia trying to disavow voters, if there is possibly any of that happened in Virginia with this election.
From what I've read and what the examination of the recount has indicated, that there really wasn't any shenanigans in the voting.
Hold on just a second, Jenny, because we have something somewhat similar on our Facebook page from Robert, who says, I hope you discuss the rules change on provisional ballots based on an opinion from Ken Cuccinelli's office. I don't understand it, but it smells fishy to me. Can you respond to both of these?
I can respond to both.
Dr. Roberts?
The rule change was whether you had it wasn't really a rule change, but a clarification of the existing rule, whether you had like our guest on the phone a minute ago, you had to come personally and show your ID. And that was the intent of the law to begin with. So that was a story that probably got out of control a little bit in terms of whether there were shenanigans in Fairfax County Board, which there wasn't. Statewide, there isn't any. No one's alleging that there've been shenanigans in terms of counting the votes, et cetera, et cetera. So there has been hiccups in terms of counting the votes, but there isn't any indication that there was an attempt to manipulate the election by not handing out absentee ballots or throwing ballots away or something normally associated with ballot fraud.
Jenny, I'm just picking up on the clues I thought I heard here, but it sounds to me like it's possible that if your daughter agrees with your political views, that she would have voted for the guy who won for governor.
Yeah, but, you know, I think about that AG, and we see what happened when we had Ken Cuccinelli as AG. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And especially because I think this speaks grandly to the man's character, that he doesn't have the dignity to just bury the hatchet and call the guy, you know? In this day and age, that shows to me the kind of person I want as a leader in our government. And regardless of what party you are, you need to be a grown-up, you know? Pull up your big boy pants and do it, you know?
Jenny, thanks for giving us a call. There's so many things that I was resisting saying in response to that comment, and I think I should just leave it where it was and go to Anita, because we're getting close to the end of the hour, Anita. And we haven't talked much yet about what Mr. McAuliffe is doing in preparation for his transition into the governor's mansion. Can you give us some info on that?
Sure. Well, he is doing what is generally done. Obviously, he's had a press conference in Richmond and met with the local media there. He's started a transition team and also started looking towards the inauguration. So he's appointed some folks to help with his transition, and he has spoken and tried very hard in this transition team to be bipartisan. He said he was going to do that. Clearly, there are more Democrats than Republicans here, but he has included some Republicans in his team, and he's also appointed as his sort of the top transition official, someone who's pretty well known to Virginia political people, who worked for Mark Warner when he was governor and Jim Webb when he was a senator, and that's Paul Reagan. And so I think he's going to help, he'll start looking at all the people that he should hire for his administration, and I think Paul's going to help him with that.
Bob Gibson, in the 45 seconds we've got left, I'm wondering if you can peer into your crystal ball and tell us anything about when we've got a new governor as of the beginning of January and a new legislative session starting in January. What's going to be on the agenda?
Well, it's clear that the whole issue area of ethics will be on the agenda. And it's not clear what they're going to do about it. There will be calls to broaden gift reporting. There will be calls to limit gifts that are reported.
This is because of the troubles that the current governor has.
Well, the current governor, the current attorney general, both have had gifts from Star Scientific chief executive whose gifts to the governor became the subject of a federal investigation.
And you think this time that ethics reform could pass?
No, I'm saying that it will be considered and debated.
Not passed.
Yeah, Anita?
And I was just going to say that he has a tough time ahead of him, Terry McAuliffe, on a variety of things. We haven't really talked about it, but the House of Delegates was on the ballot. The Democrats only picked up one seat.
Right.
It's predominantly Republican still. Veto-proof, the whole thing.
It's so hard to say goodbye to you guys. I just hope we can get back together again soon. Our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, as well as McClatchy Newspaper's White House correspondent and Charlottesville native, Anita Kumar. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find postings of Virginia Insight online at WMRA.org when you go to Programs and then click on Virginia Insight. And when you get to the page for today's show, you'll find more information about Bob, Anita, and Bob and the work that they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.